we're surrounded by stories that just don't add up. Choices that appear to be baffling, actions that defy logic. But what if there's more to the story? On How Did It Make Sense, we explore the power of learning from experience and digging into the second stories that are always present. We talk to experts from diverse fields who are challenging the way we think about safety, risk, and decision making. Join us as we unlock the lessons hidden within everyday events. Some of these are high risk and some appear to be mundane, but all of them show how we can create a fairer, safer, and more resilient world. Welcome to the next episode of How Did It Make Sense, in which we start to look at the local rationality of those involved in events. We hear these first stories, these simple stories, which are often laden with blame and counterfactuals, but there's always a deeper story behind that. Today, I've got Anne Stowe, who actually, I can't remember how we met, so we might have to sort of put that together, but we've been in contact with each other many years now. So Anne, who are you? What do you do? What do you do? You know, how did you get to where you are? And where can people find you in the real world and the online space if they want to get hold of you after this podcast? Cool.
I have a business called Humanize Work, and I focus on people, values, culture for what I call better organizations, so people feel better and more confident about their work, and also businesses are making more money for themselves as well. So I think about people, planet, and profit, but mostly with a focus on people, if I'm talking to people. And as I was saying to you just before, someone called me a business therapist the other day, and I quite liked that because I tend to spend a lot of my time sitting, talking to people and listening, and we work things out together rather than actually me telling people what to do, because they don't always know what their problem is until they've actually talked about it. And I do a thing with SMEs usually called an organizational ethnography, where I go in and talk to the people that actually are front line, so that we can find out what the policies, processes and things like that are working and aren't working for them. So I spend a lot of my time listening and talking to people, which is what I like doing best. I guess my background, I'm a chartered psychologist. I met you just outside the Defence Academy. Somebody introduced us a while ago. And I did social and behavioural research and education for the Ministry of Defence for around about 20 years. So thinking about that collection of stories about what people have learned and what they've done, I've been really fortunate to meet a lot of really interesting people in interesting places. So I gather those stories and try and help pass those on so other people can learn from that too.
So the gist of this podcast is about storytelling. So, you know, we've discussed briefly what you were going to talk about, and there was a bit of reticence on your side because you said, look, you know, it's not the losing limbs type stories that are in here. Yeah. Actually, one of the things that I brought out in a number of these episodes so far is that these first and second stories don't just exist at the sharp end, the frontline operator space where people are dealing with energy and harm and hazards, but actually that local rationality exists at all levels within the organization. And so so tell us this first story that you've got, Anne, and summarize the event.
Yeah, so I'm talking to you today about merger of a large organization that spotted an SME that it thought really fitted its direction of travel in terms of work and business, and that were doing extraordinarily well. So the SME had been in existence for probably 15 years thereabouts. They were made up of a number of different people that had worked together for a long, long time and were an extraordinarily successful little business, but still quite small. That's what they wanted. They were small and niche, and the big business came along and decided to take them over. So after a lot of discussion and negotiation, the merger was agreed and went ahead. Within about 3 to 6 months of this happening, nearly all the senior leadership from the SME had resigned. They'd gone, they'd walked out. This had a knock-on effect on operations. It meant that more people were scrutinising what was going on. The stakeholders and shareholders were questioning whether this had been a good idea in the first place. And they re-evaluating their relationship with both organisations, which meant it started fragmenting quite quickly. So the brand value took a plummet and so did share prices. So people that were working for the SME actually thought, oh, I see what's happened here. They've taken the money and run, and they've left us to deal with the fallout from this. And they felt that they'd been misrepresented, mismanaged, and just really felt let down.
You could sort of summarise that as, and I'm pretty sure that this is a feeling that often sort of those within a taken over organisation as the leadership's taken the money, they've legged it, and they've left us with this, and they don't really care about what's happened.
Exactly.
But actually, there's always more to it than this. So, and that's where we come into these second stories. Mm-hmm. And, you know, understanding how that situation developed in the way it did, it would be quite easy to apply counterfactuals to that first story. They should have done this. They could have done that. Whereas actually, let's hear the second story. So what's the local rationality of everybody, actually, not just that SME, but also the larger organization who thought, actually, this seems like a good idea, but at the same time, that the sort of the outcomes weren't as expected. Mm-hmm.
So the reason really for the, well, there were multifold, obviously, reasons for the guys leaving when they did. It was about kind of hidden pressures, personal state that they'd had in the organization before. A lot of it's linked to cultural misalignment and mostly poor communication from both sides of the story. So the merger was rushed and pushed through. There was a lack of attention to detail and foresight regarding the integration. Everybody thought it would just happen in a certain way. And it was what I would call process heavy, trust light. So it was very, very driven by the larger organisation without any kind of consideration of how that would feel to the other organisation. And it's pretty common, this, you know, 2 out of 3 mergers actually fail because of a cultural misalignment and this lack of integration foresight about the integration and how to do it. So there was a lack of clarity in communications about what would actually happen post the merger, who would be responsible for what, who would work on what. So the roles were very misaligned. People were duplicating work, working longer hours, trying to fill in 2 lots of reporting forms. There was a perceived lack of appreciation of the decades of expertise that these guys had actually built up informing the SME. And they felt like they were being ridden roughshod over. The new organisation was pushing through changes, and it felt left them feeling like they just weren't trusted or just like they didn't fit.
So there's a couple of bits that come to mind straight away as, you know, not just about mergers and acquisitions, but often about businesses and safety operations or safe operations and 2 performance shaping factors. One there is time. Uh-huh. So there's this bit that it has to be rushed through. So first question I'm going to ask is about what were the time drivers? Were the time drivers as important as there was a perception that? But also that bit of trust and the assumptions that go into that. So 2 questions then really is, what were the time drivers? Because actually that probably shapes an awful lot of what was going on.
Yeah, though other than that, the kind of acquiring organization really wanted to control. That was their culture. They liked control and hierarchy, and they wanted to gain control of the organization that they just purchased as quickly as possible. So they were trying to centralize everything, push the changes through, make them work in their way, rather than actually spending time to listen to what actually worked for the smaller organization and understand the culture of collaboration and flexible approach that they had and the relationships that they had with their clients and their stakeholders. So there was a complete lack of understanding of how it actually worked in reality, as opposed to, that's a nice little organization, let's just make it work like us. And there are a couple of really big...
Had they done any other acquisitions in the past as well? Because, you know, that bit of there is a lack of, often that's because either it's learned behaviors or they've done it before and it's succeeded and it's succeeded. So they don't need to change their behaviors.
No, exactly.
So in that sense is, you know, is it a learned behavior or is it a naive behavior? And so, well, this is actually how it works. Because it's seen as you talk about, a process rather than actually an interaction and a collaborative approach.
Yeah, it was very much seen as, this is a process we need to do. They'd not done it before. They just assumed that, God bless assumptions, eh? It was assumed that that would...
Well, they're all normal.
No, yeah. Exactly. It was assumed that they would just be, everything would be okay, that the processes would suddenly align. A little bit of naivety, I would suggest, in terms of the larger organization, because they hadn't done it before. And I think sometimes it's kind of sold that once you take someone over, they will work in your way, rather than actually appraise which are the best approaches from the two organizations and try to find out how those cultures and values and processes and ways of working would work best for both of them together, rather than imposing a certain way of working.
Almost as if that process has to be done before something is agreed.
Right.
Because once you've agreed, then you're actually committed to it and you end up with a whole bunch of sunk costs and say, right, this is what we're going to do. Sure. We push it through. We have to do it because we've committed to doing this. And then you're going to start eroding the goodwill and the trust that exists within the organizations.
Absolutely.
You know, my last job in the Air Force was writing requirements, user requirements, systems requirements to be able to go out to procure capabilities. And one of the hardest bits was trying to go out to stakeholders and say, what is it you need in terms of capability? Not what's shiny, we want one of those boxes or you want one of those.
Yeah.
And actually, I think it probably that same issue exists at a merger and acquisition point of view is, what is it that both parties want? What do we want to achieve in terms of a capability? And what are the barriers and what's the minimum sort of pass piece? And do those stakeholders get engaged? And that brings us into the trust piece. So what's your experience about trust in this sort of space?
It's difficult because I think people find it very difficult to communicate with both sets of employees, really, about what the expectations are. I've been through a couple of mergers and a couple of acquisitions, and I've sat on the outside of a couple as well. And in every single case, the organisation that's been taken over or acquired has refused to tell their employees what's going on because they don't want to scare the horses. But actually, that lack of communication scares the horses. Everybody gets worried. Nobody likes surprises. People get worried about what's going on. Are their jobs safe? So you've already got a little bit of a rocky thing going on there. And then the other organisation, the acquiring organisation, fails to let their people know what's going on. And the consideration of roles and responsibilities on who's going to be responsible for what, unless that's really clearly thought through, you end up with this duplication of effort, people trying to, you know, standing on each other's toes, and just unclear lines of reporting. And so things like that really make people uneasy, nervous, and very unsettled and wanting to go. Because if you don't like that, you get lower retention, you get higher sickness levels, you get people backbiting, arguments behind the scenes, people cutting corners. We know all about that. And so,
yeah.
You know, it's just that I worked for a brewery that was acquired by another brewery, and I was part of a team that were implementing a new till system and stock taking system across the whole estate. And the acquirers hadn't said that they wanted this actual system in. We ended up sitting around for 2 months with nothing to do because nobody had made that decision before the acquisition took place. It's really terrifying.
There's a couple of things that spring to mind here. One is this idea of pre-mortems and red, you know, applied critical thinking, red teaming.
Yeah.
That goes into that, and of actually, you know, what ifing this scenario and playing the worst games out, and not because they're going to occur that way, but because that gives you an option to sit there and go, right, when this does happen, how do you resolve it, as opposed to the pushback and say it might not. And the other one that came to mind just now was there's a connection on LinkedIn, a guy called Brian Rivera Ponch does a podcast called No Way Out. And he and I think an awful lot align the same way because of the sort of the backgrounds we've got. And he put a post up that drew a link back to something around about 2016. And it was all about doing stand downs. And it was doing a stand down in a software company. So taking a whole day out to understand what was going on and basing this on safety stand downs that happen predominantly in the aviation community, but in other high-risk industries as well, where they basically say, right, we're going to stop work for a whole day. And, you know, there's sort of the accountants and the production people go, oh, my God, you're going to do what?
Yeah.
And I'm just thinking, you know, for something like a merger where there is this bit of we can't, you know, this perception of we can't afford to lose production productivity over those days, when actually if you stopped for a day or a two, and actually understood what you were doing and the roles and responsibilities and reset the whole game.
Absolutely.
Then actually you're probably going to get a whole bunch of stuff back that you're not going to lose in the future.
Yeah. I think the other thing that I often think about is the language that people use, because I've worked with the military for a long time. I've also worked with overseas police forces. And the language that you use, so even between the tri-services, the language is very different. The acronyms are different. Different things to different people. And that kind of corporate speak that people, you know, it's inclusive when you're in it, but it's very exclusive when you're from outside. That those particular phrases that people use, as soon as you smash those two cultures together and the languages are different as well, then it makes it so, so challenging for people to actually even be understood. So without taking that time to understand each other, you're bound to have kind of clash in the middle.
Just even the language you use there is smashed as actually what's there. And I saw a video the other day of non-Newtonian fluids, and I thought this would make a great sort of piece to talk about in social media, is the fact that, you know, you can sink into that and it doesn't go anywhere.
Yeah.
But you can put your hand in slowly and it sinks through.
Yeah.
And actually it's that bit that says, if we've got, you know, one of those cultures is the fluid and the other culture is the object going into it, was actually if we bring them together, we can start to absorb one into the other and we can pull the best out versus smash them in and you end up with that tension that's there.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I like that. I'll have to look into that when I finish this.
Well, it's one of the things that I love is about trying to get these ideas across from multiple spaces, multiple domains, multiple ideas.
Yeah.
And to explain ideas that, you know, that's a story. In terms of what, you know, you've explained some of the background.
Mm.
Did you manage to speak to the leadership who left and find out, you know, their rationality and also the leadership that remained about how they tried to build the bridges, or did the companies fracture and basically fail? So what was the outcome and what led to that outcome?
I think so. I didn't talk to the ones that had left. I think just capturing a little bit of what they said as they were going really was about just feeling like they didn't fit anymore. And it's that it's that kind of literally, you know, they changed the square peg and put a round hole in there, and that was like everybody felt not great. And the ultimate thing was that this kind of hemorrhaging of personnel happened right the way across the organization, the SME organization. So they lost a lot of expertise. They lost a lot of experience. They lost the people that were really carrying that original culture. So it became very subsumed and very hierarchical and not a nice place to work anymore. So it lost its reputation. And so that damaged both organizations' reputation in the long term. Because people that had left saying, talking about the big organization, talking about the bigger organization, that as not being a great place to work, as being a terrible place to be, you know, and that might not actually have been the case if they'd given it a time. But it happens, as I say.
And I think time's an interesting piece there of actually, you know, which time are we talking about? Are we talking about early time to understand?
Yeah.
Or are we talking about longer time where we hope that we can resolve it? But if people are, if the big organization is doubling down and saying, right, this is how we do it, it's either our way or the highway, you have to conform to us. But interestingly, the reason that you as the big organization have procured us is because you want our capabilities. And it's not just about that culture. Yeah. It's that tacit knowledge, that the IP that exists within those smaller organizations, that once that's gone, you're not going to get it back. And I think, you know, that bit about reputational risk, reputation is held by other people, not by you.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that makes it really hard to understand what's the reputational impact of something.
Yeah.
And if you haven't created an environment where you can go out to people and say, you know, and they can give you candid responses, you're never going to find out where those gaps are.
No, exactly. And I think that's part of what we talk about having a whole view, taking that context in, that actually, and you saying about taking that step back is really important, because if you don't understand the context that both organisations are working in and where the crossovers are and where the gaps are, then you're not going to make the right decisions as you're going in. And that kind of reputational loss is an intangible in all this, but so crucial right the way through.
Do you know if the organization, the procuring organization, ever did any, you know, after action review debriefs, or, you know, it doesn't sound like they did exit interviews for those who left, whether or not they speak to them or not, but, you know, there are huge opportunities for learning when people walk out the door and you sit there going, see ya, bye, don't let the door hit you on the way out. And you sit there going, there is a whole bunch of learning that you could get from those people.
No, and very few people do that. Very few organisations actually bother to do that. And you're quite right. The reason that they took it on in the first place was because it was vibrant, it was innovative, it was heralded as having great ideas, being, you know, at the forefront of their thinking, being a great place to work, being a good, almost a good example in their, you know, their sector. And then they came in and squished it.
And did that? So, you know, I'm guessing the big organization didn't do a debrief, but did they even reflect as to what may have caused this? And did they do any learning? You know, we've talked in the past about the difference between lessons learned and lessons identified and just lessons. And, you know, if you don't reflect on this, you're going to make the same mistakes again, because you could just turn around and say, it was the small company's problem that this failed. Yeah. As opposed to actually, this is a system issue that we need.
Yeah, there was a bit of finger pointing at the SME's leadership that left, saying, well, they let us down, which kind of wasn't the case. But it's, you know, that learning, oh, well, we need to handle them better rather than what we did was wrong. And I think there's an awful lot of that blame, pointing blame to someone else. when you actually, you should be actually looking in your own house first. And so I don't think I would suggest, and I may be wrong, but I would suggest that there were no lessons learned. There were lessons identified, but not learned. And I don't know if they've tried taking anyone else over since or what's happened with that, but that particular one, I don't think they'll...
Even the lessons identified from what you just said there is often it's pointing down the hill. Yeah. And the lesson is, we don't want to have leadership like that in a company that we procure or we acquire.
Yeah.
Whereas actually the lesson really is the bit where we need to look in the mirror.
Yeah.
It's really, really hard.
Yeah, it is really difficult. And it's difficult to get people to acknowledge that they don't do that. So, you know, if you say to people, do you do an after action review? Do you do that? Oh, yes, of course we do. But then what do you do with the findings from that? And we've seen this, even in public inquiries, right? That, you know, there've been public inquiries that have gone on for years and then come out with 20 recommendations that have never been acted on.
Absolutely. And actually, that was one of the bits we were involved in a Ministry of Defence fatality review. Right. And that was one of the points that we pulled up, was there were a number of previous recommendations that hadn't been encountered. And so, you know, I take my hat off to the person who was responsible for addressing that, because for the recommendations we made, they didn't close any of them down until something had been put in place and they'd measured the effectiveness of it, because they weren't happy that we'd identified a whole bunch of stuff that hadn't been closed in the past. And so... Absolutely. Just because you've made a recommendation, it doesn't mean that it's closed.
Yeah.
Now, it could be that you can close it because you can turn around and say it's uneconomically viable.
Yeah.
We're willing to tolerate that risk or whatever it is. But you have to have some action that says we are actively dealing with that recommendation and we've dealt with it, as opposed to just let it sit in the shelf somewhere.
Yeah, absolutely.
So what would be your, you know, what would be your lessons from this for others who are listening? I'm conscious that when I've done these sessions in the past, it's like, yeah, we've got that talking. So it's like, yeah, but so what? You know, so what would be an explicit three takeaways from this event, from the second story that others could use, not just in mergers and acquisitions piece, but also from other interactions and relationships within organizations?
I think there's an awful lot to be said for listening and learning. As I say, kind of that what I call an organizational ethnography that gives people a voice. Because when people feel heard, they're much more likely to share more information with you as well. The people that are actually doing the job, they know the workarounds, they know what's good, what's bad about the organisation, they know, they understand the relationships that are there. And I think it's making sure that certainly in mergers and acquisitions, but even within any organisation where there's lots of different departments, make sure that you know that you're speaking each other's language, you understand what you mean when you're there, and make sure you factor the cultural and people synergies in to all this. So there is an awful lot of listening and learning and giving it time, understanding what people's roles and responsibilities are and making sure that you're communicating things really clearly. So the best example I've seen of this is where an incoming company were very open about what they wanted to do and had like a monthly meeting with everyone at from about the month before they took over, going, right, when we come in, these are the things that are going to happen. These are the things that we're going to want to know. This is how we're going to communicate with you. And made it really clear and transparent, because then people aren't panicking about what's coming in. It's just clarity. Sounds simple.
That's spot on. And it's interesting that I would also... And I'm guessing part of that month-long sort of interview process is asking the questions, what do you want? What do you need? Yeah. What are your concerns? What are your worries? And being and creating the environment where those individuals, that sort of acquired company, or even the acquiring company, can give honest responses, because there is a level of psychological safety and the candor can be shared.
Yeah.
I'm thinking about the conversation we had outside the old Bell in Malmesbury, and actually just what you talk about is the slow bit and actually the gardening side rather than the mass production piece that goes on. And I think that's it's a really interesting analogy there. So tell people about your gardening side. I mean, is that still going on? Because that ties in really quite nicely with what we're talking about here is growing organizations rather than forcing organizations.
Absolutely. I still do a little bit of design. So I do garden design. My first show garden got a gold. I was still very pleased at that. So that was useful experience. I've written a Medium post about planting a, what was it? Not an aubergine. Anyway, never mind. I wrote a Medium post about the difference between putting an unusual piece, a plant, in the same bed as you wouldn't normally plant them in and see how they grow. So it's about it, but it is about giving things time, nurturing it, understanding the conditions for things to grow. And it is there is a lot of crossover in there about, you know, there's seasons as well for everything. Things grow better certain seasons, and people are the same, that they work in certain ways and take to different environments better. So that's really useful to know what nourishes and nurtures you and helps you grow.
Excellent. I will put a link to that Medium post in the show notes as well. So the final sort of part of this podcast is a book or an article or a video or multiple versions of that you'd recommend that others go and watch or read or consume because it's shaped your view of the world.
I thought long and hard about this, and there are a few, but one in particular, and it's a really, really old book, but it was the thing that really sparked my interest in psychology and people and behaviour. And it was a Pelican book from 1966. I'm not quite old enough to have read it when it first came out. And it was by George A. Miller, and it was called The Psychology, The Science of Mental Life. It's still available, and you can buy secondhand ones, obviously, all over the place. It was redone in 1991, and my grandfather bought it me as something that he thought I would find interesting as I got older. And then when I finally got round to reading it, I understood why, because it really opened my eyes to psychology in real life and how it connected through. So that's an amazing book. But I would also say anything on systems thinking or systems integration, really, really useful. The other thing that I really like, hang on, I've lost it, is Freedom to be Happy by Matt Phelan, who's the Happiness Index guy. A really, really interesting book. A good read. And it, you know, people think about the Happiness Index and they go, oh, they think everyone should always be happy at work all the time. No, it's quite practical and pragmatic. We know everybody can't be ecstatic all the time, but it is about how to engage with your employees and give them that psychological safety to be great at work.
Excellent. Well, thank you very much for your time, Anne. I really appreciate this conversation. It's great to catch up because it's been a number of years since we sat outside the pub in Malmesbury and talked about where things are. And so pleased to have you on here. And so pleased to be able to talk about a different story, that the understanding of the local rationality at those levels within organizations. And often those levels are missed because their outcomes are often so diffuse. Mm-hmm. You know, whereas somebody can, if they're in a sort of a high energy hazard environment, that decision ends up with a response there and then, and it's very obvious. Yeah. Whereas actually the decisions that happen at the higher levels in the organization take longer and reach wider to create success or failure as we go along. So Anne, thank you very much for your time. I will catch up with you soon.
Hopefully so. Thanks very much for inviting me along. I've really enjoyed it. Thanks, Gareth.